Hi everyone, this is Brian Reisman, host of Side Jams, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Be sure to keep up with the show on Facebook, Instagram, or through my Brian Reisman account on Twitter.
Hi, this is Reese Fulber from Frontline Assembly. You're listening to Side Jams with Brian Reisman on the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Singer and musician Gary Numan is the synth-pop and synth-rock pioneer who first came to prominence at the dawn of the 1980s with singles like I Die, You Die, We Are Glass, and the number one UK hits Our Friends Electric and, of course, Cars. Since that time, he has been a prolific composer. His latest release, Intruder, is his 19th studio album and examines the climate change crisis from the point of view of Mother Earth herself. Like his previous album, Savage, Songs from a Broken World, it hit number 2 in the UK Top 10 and charted in multiple countries. Both releases serve up compellingly dark sonic tapestries that complement his diverse catalog. Check out the tunes I Am Screaming and Saints and Liars for a good idea of what the intriguing Intruder is like. When he has the chance to break away from making music, Gary loves to travel the globe with his wife Gemma and their three daughters, Raven, Persia, and Echo. For episode 52 of Side Jams, he shared his travel adventures along with tales of his flying days, including being an air display pilot, which you can catch a glimpse of in the vintage video for the song Warriors. Gary also talked about his interest in boating and his intermittent diversions into candle making. Along the way, we also discussed our philosophies of life, and he described how having Asperger's has been a benefit throughout his pioneering music career. This was my first time speaking with Gary, who made for a truly enlightening and entertaining interviewee.
Well, I'm enjoying the new album.
Oh, good. Thank you.
It's funny because I see a lot of interviews with you where you specifically talk about, you know, like you're obviously you love making new music. You've been making a lot of new music over the years, you know, and everyone's like, let's go back to the 80s. I'm like, yeah, but there's a new album. And like your last album hit number 2 in England. I mean, it's like, which is great, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's been times when it's been a bit frustrating, but I understand. Yeah, I understand the legacy side of it. It's just you don't want it to dominate. You know, it's a small part of a bigger conversation.
It is. I'm a big proponent of listening to new music by veteran artists. You know, like I love the last Billy Idol record. 10 years ago, Duran Duran did a great album. And the last album was good too, but the last one was kind of like an updating of their 80s stuff, but it was more mature lyrics, better musicianship. Like people grow and evolve. The last Judas Priest album I loved. I mean, it was just people that are still putting out music that's relevant, and critics always discuss about relevancy. I'm like, well, you know, if you got several hundred or several thousand people showing up a night to your shows, it's relevant to somebody.
Yeah.
You know? And I think in England and Europe too, they embrace that more than I think in the States in some ways.
Do you know what? I've often thought it's the opposite. I've often found America to be far more willing to enjoy it, sort of, which I'm not actually a fan of, you know, but far more sort of willing to still be into people that haven't done anything relevant for like 30 years, and they're still going, oh yeah, yeah, great, and still go to the concerts and still just listen to those old songs. And I've always thought that was more prevalent in America than it is in Europe, where I've always thought of Britain as being much more sort of ruthlessly interested in the next new thing and very quick to dispose of people that were there a little bit before. It's very difficult to longevity is more difficult in Britain. Not impossible, obviously, but more difficult because they are so obsessed about finding the next new thing. You know, they tend to dismiss or dispose of previous sort of successes.
You know, it's funny. I can't keep up. I cover everything. I do music, movies, TV, comic books, books, and my brain is always on overload. I mean, this past year, I spent a lot of time making money on Blu-ray commentaries for movies from like the 60s to the 90s. And then I was like, oh my God, I have to catch up now with like streaming. I'm like, yep, that's not going to happen. You just have to, and even your music, I'm newer to your music, you know, in the 80s, I was a metal kid.
Oh, really?
So I listened to a lot of some of this stuff early, but then I was like, yeah, you know, I was into heavy. I was an honor student that loved really heavy rock. And so in recent years, like the synthwave movement, for example, has now gotten me back into discovering things like your music. Then I knew that you had a lot of albums out. So now I'm enjoying, you know, I enjoyed listening to Savage, and Conversely, I discovered Human League were like almost an industrial group before they became pop. I was like, oh, didn't know that. So like all of a sudden there's this history of music that expands, especially with streaming now. People can more easily discover what's going on.
Yeah.
And I've noticed in your music, there's an Eastern influence going on. Like I listened to the last album. There's a couple of songs in the last album, you know, including My Name is Ruin that have that Eastern vibe. And the new album opens up with that. I think with Betrayed, there's that same kind of vibe going on. I'm kind of curious where that comes from.
It's really just a fascination with Middle Eastern melodies are to a Western ear are unpredictable.
Yes.
And I never really know where they're going. With a Western melody, you kind of got a good idea, you know, even lyrically, where it's, you know, a line will start and you know, think I know where this is going. And it does usually, usually ends up exactly where you think it's going to go. I like that. I like the unpredictability of where it's going. And so I try to bring that element in into what I do.
Quarter tones too, right? I mean, they
and there's where you slide just off the note and back again. That sort of thing. And I love all that. I'm not particularly good at it, but I love all that sort of thing. And on Intruder, there's a musician called Gorkum Sen who I was able to get on it, who's Turkish. And he's invented this instrument called a Yebahar, the only one of its kind in the world that I'm aware of. And
really?
Yeah, every time I see a photograph of it, it looks a bit different to the time before. So I think he's still working on it. You know, I think he's still adding bits to it.
is it like, what does it sound like, or what was it inspired by?
Well, it's definitely got a Middle Eastern feel to it. But to look at it, it's a central stem with strings.
It's a string instrument, okay.
Yeah, but not many. And he plays it with finger or with bow. But connected to that, it appears to be a lot of like very long wobbly springs,
yeah,
which are connected to different types of drums, and the drums change depending on what he's doing.
Yeah.
So he'll be playing all this amazingly Middle Eastern sounding stuff. It's beautiful. He's fantastic at what he does. And then he sort of leans forward and he hits one of these springs and this other stuff happens. You know, whoa, what is that? You know, so it's like a synthesizer, but totally organic. Do you know what I mean? It's
perfect for you because you're doing all the electronic stuff.
So. It's amazing. So it gave me everything that I wanted. You know, sounds that I'd never heard before, but with a Middle Eastern sort of vibe running through the whole thing. Totally unique. You know, it took me a while to convince him to play on the record because he's invented this thing. This is his life. He's put his whole life into developing this instrument, and he's really protective about it. He doesn't want someone like me coming along, getting him to play on the record, and stealing all the sounds and making a sample CD and selling it, you know, and cutting him out completely. So I had to spend some considerable time, you know, reassuring him and signing various bits of paper that I would not do that, you know. And I tried to explain to him, you know, I said, no, you sort of try to understand that the reason I want you on it is because you are unique. You know, it totally defeats the object of that if I then go and sell all those sounds. And I'm not, you know, I don't have a history of stealing people's sounds and selling them.
You know, everybody else samples your sounds instead.
Yeah, Google me. Yeah. Google me and you'll find that I'm quite above board. But he's lovely. He's such a lovely person, very gentle. And he just needed some reassurance, you know, and I completely understand where he's coming from. So I gave him that. He played on three songs, three songs, actually, on the album. Amazing contribution, especially in the third song. You played on a song called The Gift.
Yep.
And that song really, we were really able to let the Yebahar kind of do its thing towards the end of the song. In the first two, it's sort of more ethereal background, kind of just weird atmospheric noises. Essential, you know, they really do need to be there. But on The Gift, he does like this solo at the end of it, and it's just beautiful. But when I first heard it, you know that, you know, so the hairs on your arm stand up?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a nonsense for the most part, isn't it? But it did. Absolutely did. Whoa, look at that. You know, so it was a real moment for me, and it was amazing. I'm really grateful and honoured to have him on it.
It seems to be a continuation, a bit of the post-apocalyptic kind of vibe from the last album. There's a couple, some of the lyrics on here are like I am screaming in it and it breaks me again, you know, are interesting because they actually couldn't not only just relate to that kind of a world, but they kind of relate to the modern world at this point, especially after the pandemic we were just through.
Yeah. Well, Intruder set in the now. I mean, that the album before Savage was a post-climate apocalyptic future. And it looked at the human condition, really, in that what would people become in that world? What would they need to become to survive? And how would that affect them? And would they be haunted by that? Would they realize that this was awful, you know, that humanity wasn't always like that? You know, that was what I was trying to do with Savage. This one is very, very different. Although it still has climate change as its theme, this one tries to give voice to the planet. If the planet could speak or sing, you know, what would it say? You know, how does it feel? How would it express the way it feels now? How does it feel about us and what we're doing to it? So that's the whole idea behind Intruder. So very much set in the now, not science fiction, not looking at the future, but how does the Earth feel today, you know, about what we're doing to it? And it all came from a poem. My youngest is called Echo. My youngest daughter is called Echo. Yeah. And she wrote a poem about 2 years ago called Earth when she was 11. And it's pretty much Intruder. You know, it's the Earth talking to the other planets in the solar system, explaining to them why the Earth is sad and all the horrible things that people have done to it. And it was really lovely and very sort of sensitive and sort of lots of empathy. And I was really proud of her. But I shamelessly stole it and turned it into an album.
Stealing from your children.
Shameless. But I've given a, you know, I'm being honest, I'm fessing up to everybody. And when the album comes out, you know, you open the gatefold and her poem is there in full in it, on the artwork. So I even paid her for it the other day.
Excellent.
So it's all above board, you know, nothing underhand going on.
But that's all covered.
That's where it came from. You know, it was because of my 11-year-old and what she had done.
For my podcast or side jams, and I talk a bit about music, and I talk about people's outside passions and their hobbies, you know. And I know one of the things that you're big on, even at least before the pandemic hit us, is that you're big on traveling. In fact, you just did an interview with Soundsphere, where you mentioned that in a year and a half period, you guys had gone to 28 different countries, which probably explains the diversity in a lot of your music, for one thing, and you're interested in, say, for example, Arabic music. Have you always been like that? Is that something that came along once you're more successful in music and had the ability to travel?
It expanded with the music success, but even before that, I was lucky in that my dad used to work at British Airways.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he got cheap flights. Mm-hmm. So we were able to travel into the Europe and beyond fairly cheaply. So we did, you know, we would go to Cyprus and Malta and Spain, all different sort of places through Europe. And it was great, you know. And so I got to travel a fair bit as a kid. But then when the music thing happened, obviously that it opens up the entire world, and it's just been amazing. But my biggest interest outside of music was actually airplanes. I was an air display pilot for about 12, 15 years.
Your family life kicked in.
Well, I started flying lessons when I was about 19, I think, got my license. And then the success happened. So I had some money. So I bought my own airplane and got into that. Started my own airplane company at one point called Newman Air.
Do you have any photos of a plane with your logo on it still?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do somewhere. I had a few. Then I flew around the world for an adventure in 1981. Got arrested in India on suspicion of smuggling and spying. That was weird. Had loads of
how long was that interrogation?
4 days they kept us for.
Oh my god!
It was pretty heavy actually.
So you can withstand any music criticism at this point after dealing with that for 4 days.
Yeah, that was a weird one.
So they just had you in a room? They just kept you jailed somewhere?
Well, it was really weird, actually. We were flying around the world. We were actually, we'd been in Madras, and we were flying from Madras. We went across India, up the east coast of India to an airway, and we were going to fly across the Indian Ocean to Thailand. We flew under the airway so that if anything happened, we could communicate with the airliners and they could relay any emergency information that we might need to send them.
Okay.
So that was a reason for sort of this slightly dogleg route. We got about 60, 70 miles out and the engine started to run really ragged. So that was scary. So we turned back and got back to land and landed at a place called Vizagapatnam on the East Coast. Luckily, managed to get it back before it quit altogether. And then it all started to go horribly wrong. And they were very suspicious about why we were there. Very suspicious about the fact that we had a camera. I couldn't quite understand that. So I explained to them who I was. I said, look, I'm a British musician and we're flying around the world. And they said, why? I said, well, for an adventure, because I can, really. I've always wanted to do it. And he said, well, if you're a British celebrity, then where are all your press cuttings? As if you carry them around with you, as if you keep a little bag.
Jesus.
So I was going, that's a bit mad, And to begin with, you get all very British about it, Do you know? My passport says the might of the British Empire will come to my aid if I'm in need of it. You just be careful who you're talking to. Cause they don't give a monkeys about any of that. Then he accused us of spying on this aeroplane that was parked at this airfield, which is a thing called a Britain Norman Islander that they make in Britain on the Isle of Wight. And the man I was flying with, the other pilot, used to be a test pilot for Britain Norman. So I was trying to explain to the authorities, he's probably flown that actual plane that you're telling us that we're spying on. And it's just a little twin engine propeller plane. Who's going to spy on that? It wasn't like some latest fast jet, stealth technology. Mickey Mouse. My airplane was bigger than this. It went from silly to ridiculous. And then it got a bit frightening because they started getting quite heavy and they put us up in this place where they kept us for 4 days. It wasn't a prison or a police station, but it wasn't very nice. And then they would come like 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, the door would come banging open and they would come flying in, all had guns. Why are you here? Why are you here? Took our passports off us. It was really horrible. It wasn't, at the time, it wasn't fun at all, And,
but it'll be in your autobiography. This.
Oh yeah, no, I did it. A book came out in October, so it's all in there. But it's a really, really interesting thing to sort of talk about now. I was absolutely not enjoying it at all when it was going on. I was really glad to get away.
Isn't it interesting how, like, Western society is so obsessed with celebrity, and other cultures are like, whatever. Like, they it doesn't really matter to them. Which, of course, explains why we've had such crappy behavior during the pandemic, where everyone's concerned with themselves. Whereas, look, we look at Asian culture, and a lot of us think of it as stoic and very conform, especially in China, which is communist. But you have Japan, you have South Korea, you have Thailand, all these other countries, and their sense of respecting other people's boundaries has worked a lot better. Especially, Japan's having some problems again, but still, a lot of these countries have taken a different approach, whereas here, we want to do whatever we want, whenever we want. And it's actually not really how it works, which ties into what you're talking about with your album, being from the perspective of Mother Earth, of the planet. Yes. It's like, you guys think you can do whatever you want, but there's a price to this, which is what I think the pandemic is about. Mother Nature, to me, is sending us a message. And I'm not sure people are getting it. I think everyone wants to be normal, quote unquote, again. I don't think it's going to be normal completely again, because we don't know what's going to happen yet.
No. There's a song on the album called The Gift. I think it's the third song in. And that's specifically about COVID. And it takes the argument that, COVID could be a deliberate, not human-made, but, nature. If it, my feelings were that if the nature, the Earth, or nature as a system, identifies human beings as a threat or as an infestation of some kind, which we most certainly are, there must be a mechanism within nature to deal with something like that. And so I started to think that COVID might be the Earth fighting back. That might be the first of many ever more refined attempts to cull us, even down to smaller numbers where we could be less damaging, or to kill us all completely, to get us off the face of the Earth, because the Earth would flourish without us being here. But then I started to think, maybe it's not the first. Maybe this has been going on for 100 years. Maybe we've been at war with the planet for 200-300 years. When did the Earth realize that we were a problem? It might not be now. We are becoming
at least 100 years ago it did.
Yeah. Industrial Revolution, it probably all started from then.
Yeah,
well, you know, it seems to me that we are only now becoming aware of how dangerous we are and how much damage we're doing. And we're trying to convince enough people that we need to do something about it before it's too late. And we are running out of time. This is all true. But the Earth itself might have identified us as a problem a long time ago. So, you know, COVID might not be the first. It might be one of many that have been coming for quite a while.
That's what I'm thinking of.
You know, our ingenuity and our creativity and our intelligence enables us to keep coming up with drugs that fight these things and keep them at bay or whatever, as we're doing with COVID. So we are in this war, you know, and in another few years, there'll be another one, you know, and it'll be even more deadly and more sneaky, and we'll have to fight that one. And, you know, I'm starting another album very, very soon.
I was about to say it sounds like another Gary Numan album.
Yeah. I'm really beginning to think that that might be a good theme for it. You know, this that we are at war with the planet, and it's a war that we probably don't deserve to win. You know, like, it'd probably be best if we didn't. Not that I want to die. I want my kids to want to die. But, you know, if you're talking about the survival of the planet, then, you know, get rid of us and you really don't have much of a problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you've done a lot of traveling, and you said it's important for your daughters to experience the world. How has it been for them? I mean, you've traveled a lot. I mean, I think when I was a kid, I went to Spain. You know, I went to Spain on an exchange trip for 3 weeks. My parents took me to Nova Scotia and Quebec. But we traveled around parts of the States. We had relatives in Illinois and Florida, but we didn't, you know, they tried to do as much as they could, but, you know, we're middle class and everything else.
Yeah,
they've seen a lot. How has it opened up their worldview, and how has it changed your worldview even over time?
It makes an enormous amount of difference to the way you see the world when you see it. You know, when you actually go there and experience it, it makes you far more tolerant and understanding. You realize that people all over the world are very much the same. You know, no matter what color, what culture, whatever they are, we're very much the same. We'll have the same fears and dislikes. We'll enjoy much the same things.
Yeah.
We feel pain the same. We feel pleasure the same. We're all much the same. And I think traveling is fantastic for really, really sort of putting that right in your face. You know, I've seen things. I've seen awful things. You know, I've seen... When I was younger, my idea of rich and poor was based on British culture. You know, there was... This is poor, that's rich. And then you start to travel and you find out that that is nothing like poor. Poor can be so much worse than that. And so it broadens you as a human being, and it makes you so much more aware of the struggles and the difficulties and, you know, and sympathetic to the problems of other people. You know, you don't sit at home in your nice house watching your telly with your, you know, your two cars outside and your whatever, you know, I think to be a truly decent human being, you need to be aware of what other people are going through. It's why I have so much sympathy for, you know, asylum seekers and, you know, people running from Syria and, you know, places like that. You know, the things that the things that these people are going through, you know, most people in the States or Britain, you know, will never, ever come close to even touching anything like that. And there seems to be a scathing lack of sympathy, you know, for these people and what they've gone through. And what should be a huge welcome, you know, sanctuary is not always. And it's disappointing.
Well, we're in a very big survivalist mode right now. And after the last administration we had, I mean, it's very clearly about, give me mine. It's different over here. We have a lot of creature comforts and people aren't willing to give up. I'm pretty simple. I mean, as a writer, and I know as you as a musician, the pandemic hasn't been great, but I've talked about this a lot with many guests. The fact, you know, we can hermit. I can go and I can be in my apartment for a week. I can watch movies. I can write. I can create in the world. A lot of my friends like to be out more in the world. So it's been harder for them.
Yeah,
I think. But I realize that there's things that we should, I complain more about the idiocy of other people than being quarantined. If we have to do this another 6 months, 2 years, that's what we're going to do. The last pandemic took a couple of years to go through the cycle and we're not out of this yet. And everyone's rushing out as if there's a big Hollywood ending. And we seem to like that. You know, we really do. And it doesn't quite work that way, but, you know, on a more positive note, what's been the most magical experiences your kids have had traveling? a particular country or an event, something that you thought was really great that you shared together?
Well, pretty much all of it. We took them to Bora Bora once.
Oh, really? I've never been there. I always hear about it. I'm like, what's it like?
Oh, it's just stunning. We were flying in. You could see out the windows. You look down at the island. You've got this sort of volcano and the lagoon, and it's turquoise, and it's every Pacific Island sort of Elvis Presley film you've ever seen. Just
it's amazing. All true.
Absolutely amazing. And then you land there, and you get out, and they don't have cars that take you to where you need to go. It's boats. All these boats are lined up, and you get on the boat that goes to your particular, hotel or whatever, and it's all, you're out on the water, everything goes out onto the water, the thatched cottages, and it's just stunning. And I remember looking at the kids then, and they were just absolutely blown away by this and experiencing it and taking it all in, and I was glad to see that they weren't taking it for granted. Okay. It wasn't just another place. They were really, really interested and looking at all the fish and just loving it. And I think it's things like that, and other things. Yeah, we was in Prague.
I love Prague.
Once.
What a great city.
Have you been to that church that's all bones?
I don't know if I did, actually. I remember there's the black church, that big thing on the hill.
No, it's not that one. It's
I missed it. I think it's outside the city, and I found out about it later. I was like, no.
Yeah, it's a bit of a drive to get out to it. But we went out to that, and it's just all bones. Everything is bones. It's
a horror,
it's
like, movie fan's dream.
Yeah, it's like a miniature version of the catacombs in Paris. We went to the catacombs in Paris. We went there, but the week after that Bataclan terrorist attack.
Oh yeah.
We decided to go to France in some pathetic attempt to show support for the French people. So we did that. Went to the catacombs, went to the Eiffel Tower, all over Paris. Yeah. Loved it. And again, the kids are just taking all this in. So either through touring or through the traveling that we do with just as a family outside of touring, you are constantly trying to expose them to as many cultures and people and languages as you possibly can. Yeah. And I enjoy the fact that they love it and they're fascinated by it, and they come back and they talk about it with their friends, and they do projects at school, and they talk about the places they've been to, and you can see that they learned from it and they absorbed things from it. And I think it will help them to have a much better, more positive outlook on the world as a whole, and to be less narrow in their thinking about certain issues. There's nothing bad about experiencing the world if you can, and I appreciate it's a luxury, and I'm in a fortunate position to be able to do that for them. But nonetheless, it's a good thing whether it's a luxury or not.
You've been a pilot, you also like boats. You see the world in different vehicles in different ways. How does even being a pilot and boating, how are those giving you different perspectives on the landscapes around you?
Well, I did a lot of flying. I was an air display pilot for a long time. You should do air shows all over Europe, mainly in Britain, but all over Europe.
Yeah.
That was stunningly exciting. Really dangerous, though. Pretty much everyone I knew that did it was killed.
Wow.
When I first started display flying in 83, 84, I think, I was in a team of six people. Called the Harvard Formation Team. One of those original six, four of them were killed in different crashes.
Oh my God.
The man that taught me aerobatics was killed. Pretty much everyone I knew, bar about three or four people that were doing it when I started, were gone, dead by the time I finished, got out of display flying myself. And the reason I got out of it was because having a family, I was married. The way that you can sort of treat your life with a certain amount of lack of caution when you're single.
Yeah. And young.
And young.
Or middle age, but when you're younger.
optimistic and, somewhat arrogant about your skills as a pilot. When you get older, that changes. My wife, a really close friend of ours was killed in one of my teammates in another team I was in. He was killed. And that really, really brought it home to Gemma, my wife, the dangers of it. And so from that moment on, she didn't want me to do it. So that support from home that you need, you know, because it's a pretty self-indulgent thing to do every weekend. That sure. suddenly that vanished overnight. And you know, if you love someone, you don't want them to be frightened all the time that every time you walk out the door, you're not going to come back. So, you know, I took that on board, and then the children come along, and you know, they don't want to sit at an airfield every weekend watching dad disappear into the blue distance. You know, they want to be going to the beach or going to Disneyland or whatever. Yeah. So, I just wanted to be with them. So everything sort of changed, and so I pulled out of it.
Okay.
And then I found sort of normal conventional flying just, it sounds insulting, but a little bit boring compared to being an air display pilot, which is all sort of low level and high G and dramatic, you know.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, you've talked about, I think in one interview, we were talking about thinking of getting back to, later on getting back to, this is a few years ago, I was talking about getting back to piloting or boating, maybe when the kids are grown up.
Yeah.
But by the same token, you didn't consider these things to be relaxing. You called it alternative pressure, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, well, I think relaxing is overrated, you know.
For you, yes. Well,
you know, relaxing is not necessarily fun or exciting, and, you know, pressure is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, it makes you feel like you're alive and you're doing something. I've got a real problem with not living life to the full. It's why I moved to America. I know it sounds silly,
No.
The weather in Britain is such that, you know, there's a 50-50 chance of any particular day, midsummer or not, it's going to rain and ruin everything that you plan to do for that day.
Yeah, yeah.
When I went past 50, that really started to be a problem for me. I thought, you know, I got so sick and tired of sitting indoors looking out at this lovely, beautiful green scenery, you know, through the rain, looking at puddles filling up yet again. You know, there's got to be more to life than this. You know, just stuck indoors again because you can't do anything or go anywhere.
Good thing you didn't move to Seattle.
That's where we was going to go, first of all.
Ironically.
No, yes, Seattle was the first place. And then we read about it. Oh, no, I don't fancy that. And I've been there a few times. And every time I've been there, it's been raining. As I said, not true, actually. I've been there a couple of times. It's not been raining. But yes, quite wet, isn't it?
I had to bring that
so
up.
But we both love Los Angeles, so we ended up there. But it was really to do with that, wanting, you know, to wake up in the morning and to be able to do what you'd planned to do. You know, if you want our friends over for a barbecue, it will probably happen in Los Angeles because nothing's going to stop it. In Britain, you know, it's almost certainly not going to happen. And I just got frustrated by that. And this paranoia that I've got about getting old, you know, getting sick maybe, and you know, I'm terrified of it. I'm not comfortable with getting old at all, and I want to try to live as much as I can in what time I've got left, because that's what I did before.
Yeah.
You know, I was living life, you know, and loving it all, and if it was a bit risky, that just seemed to add to the flavor of it to me. And so I mean I miss the display flying, I really do. Where I live, there's a team in an air. We live really close to an airport, a small airport, and there's a team there that fly the same airplanes that I used to fly, do the same thing that I used to do. So it just rubs salt in every weekend. They come over and I go, "Oh, I used to do that, yeah," and I miss it all again.
Hmm.
But so, yeah. luckily, the career is doing so much better now. So musically, I'm really busy, and I'm outside of a pandemic, I'm touring all the time, and so I'm kind of getting that sort of fulfilling life from that. But I miss having an exciting hobby, to be truthful.
So you were on the Graham Norton show, it's like 15 years ago now, and I think you were talking about candle making.
oh yeah, really exciting that.
Is that still a thing, or is that just a thing then?
It's not much of a thing. I still got my kit though. Still got my candle.
Well, what inspired? And I'm curious. What inspired? Because given all these other interests that you have, what got you into candle making?
Oh, I have no idea. I love it though. I don't do it often anymore. My kids want me to teach them, actually.
That's cool.
It's cool. I'm quite happy to hand over my kit to the kids. It's in good hands. I honestly don't know I get some satisfaction out of making something that's useful that I can use. So if we have a power cut, I'm not no one prouder than me when I light my own candles up to put some light on the scene. I feel really proud of myself. I even got to put in sort of aromas in them. So yeah, oh, that's not really rock and roll, is it?
You know what? Look, I just interviewed somebody about golfing. I've interviewed people about a wide variety of things. I mean, I spend a lot of time indoors. I think once this pandemic is over, I'm going to try to get out a bit more. I have the vampire thing going on. I go to bed. I was with the bed at 5 a.m. today, and I got up at about 10 because I was cranking on a story. So it gets a little surreal for some people, and I'm very creative at midnight. My mind is just, it's just there. And someone said to me years ago, it's insomnia. I'm like, it's not insomnia. I have a different body clock. And for me, coffee is proof that human beings did not want to get up early in the morning because they're always drinking lots of it. I don't drink any of it. I mean, I kind of feel very ADD where there's always something on my mind. I guess part of the reason the pandemic has been weird for me in the sense of not seeing friends, but sort of better or okay for me to handle is because I always have something I want to watch, read, write. There's always something to be absorbing. So I feel like my attention is always split in a bunch of different ways. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Yeah.
You're a parent on top of that. So your attention is split in many ways anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got three children, all teenagers now. So the pandemic's been really difficult. Yeah, really. And I've seen them deal with it very well, very well. And then it just fell off a cliff and it all just fell apart sort of just post Christmas, really. So I've been really worried about them. So, yeah, there's an added level of things to worry about compared to career and life in general. So, but, most people got kids, so we all go through it. I am very much always looking forward. I'm always thinking about what's coming and how I can shape it and what I can do to make it better for me and the family and, be it creative things or down to where you live. My wife gets frustrated with me. She says, I'm a glass half empty kind of person. And I don't quite see it like that. And the reason she says that is if a bit of good news comes in, let's say, you've got a good chart position with the album or something like that, I'll go, oh, great. And then within about 10 minutes, I'm sort of, but now what then? What next? And she would say, can't you even just spend the day enjoying the fact that you're number two or whatever? Just give it a day. She said, what comes next? I've got, there's a target now. Your brain's off you go. So I don't see it as half empty. It's sort of half one step ahead because I'm already thinking about where I'm going. It's not empty. It's just already moved on. but that's kind of the way my brain works. So yes, it is always busy because it's always thinking, trying to think ahead and spot problems. And
that's because that's what we're used to doing. And all artists have these lulls in their career. And so you certainly develop this, there's a survival instinct that kicks in. Yeah. You had success early on, but you probably went through these peaks and valleys. I had the same thing with my career. I've had some years that have been great and other years where it's not quite the same. And then you worry in the back of your mind, like, well, what do I do next? And then just artistically, I think true artists are never satisfied anyway. You'll always look back at something you did and go, oh, there's that flaw. I call myself a pessimist with an optimist streak. It's sort of like when the kids are grown up thinking of, looking in the future, do you think is boating something, for example, you might go back to?
No, my wife has banned me from having a boat. She says, you just rent one for an afternoon and you can just give it back. It makes sense, actually. What she says makes a lot of sense. Why go through the hassle of owning these things and paying for the upkeep and worrying about them when the storm, do you know what I mean? All that.
Were you a speed demon on the waves?
I'm not. It's not. I'm not about anything. My fascination with machinery, which is huge, isn't about speed. It's about power, being able to control the power of these things. It just so happens that the byproduct of that often is speed. But not always. I had a boat in Britain that used to chug along about 8 miles an hour, just crawling around the sea. But I loved it. It's really loads of motors, but just like a little ship it was. It used to power itself. I loved all that. I got really obsessed about it. I got Asperger's, so I get obsessed really easily. I get obsessed about things at the drop of a hat. So got a boat. Next thing I know, I've got about 4 or 5 different courses going on. And qualifications for this, because it become everything.
Obviously, you talked about how your Asperger's is actually a benefit to you too.
Yeah, yeah, an absolute gift. If I could live my time again, I definitely wouldn't get rid of it.
Is that in terms of juggling projects too, and all the different ideas that you have, absorbing information?
Well, it must have a bearing on it, I'm sure. It certainly colors the way you see the world. Well, certainly the way you react to the world is shaped by Asperger's. They talk about people with Asperger's having obsessive tendencies. Although that's a bad thing, I don't see it as a bad thing. In my business, it's a very, very useful thing to be obsessed about your career and music and where you're going. That sort of devotion to it. But, if you was in an airplane, you'd want your pilot to be obsessed about flying the airplane, wouldn't you? That would be a good thing.
Yeah, that would be a good thing.
Yeah, so it's, being obsessive isn't a bad thing. It's sort of got a bad press, really.
I sense like a motivational speaking tour coming up now about this.
But it gives you focus, and I'm able to emotionally sort of wrap things up and push them to one side. So, I used to get a lot of bad reviews when I started. When electronic music was new, there was a lot of hostility and resistance to it. And I kind of got the brunt of that because I was one of the first people.
I remember, I think you were very nervous before your first Top of the Pops appearance too.
Yeah, well, excited and nervous in equal measure. It was an amazing thing. But, that could have been for someone else, that could have been quite difficult, the amount of hostility that came.
Sure.
But for me, I was able to just keep, just we're going to wrap that up and just put that over there and move it to one side and just keep going. You're going this way. And all these emotions, they're just getting in the way. So we just move them to one side. Well, that's a very useful thing to be able to do. As other, it has problems in other areas. I'm not particularly good in emotional situations. I don't give the support that people need. I don't feel things quite the same way. I feel very, very deeply, but I don't feel in quite the same way. And I don't express it in quite the same way. And it's often misunderstood. And it's often not what people need.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of that. So I get very nervous if, we just had one of our cats died actually a few days ago. And it's okay.
How old is he? She?
She cat.
She, how old is she?
Don't know. We've got about 12.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I've got a lot. My wife's animal, man, 4 dogs. Still got some sheep in Britain actually. Got 7 or 8 sheep.
maybe she's getting your veterinarian's license. That could be your next, your outside project.
My next obsession, yeah.
It's tough to lose a pet. I mean, even if you have many, they all have their own personalities. And
yeah, I feel it, but my wife really suffers, really, really suffers. And I'm not good at knowing how to be with that, and I'm aware of that. I mean, I know it's a failing of mine. So I try my best to be supportive and do all the right things and say all the right things and, give a cuddle when it's necessary. But I know I'm not very good at it, and it's not natural. So there is a price to pay for the good things that come with Asperger's. My emotional way of dealing with things is very, very useful a lot of the time when it comes to career and bad reviews and stuff like that. But it's really unfortunate in other areas. Then I'm not very good socially. My social interaction with people I don't know very, very well is very awkward and clumsy, and I'm aware of that, and I can sometimes appear to be a bit arrogant or a bit aloof, and I'm not any of those things. I just don't know what to say, and it's awkward.
Well, yeah, I know it's interesting. With my job, I feel like it's made me more of a conversationalist. I think I was a lot more shy when I was young, and I have younger friends who are like, really, you're shy? And I'm like, yeah, when I was younger, I wasn't a group person. I didn't like high school. I didn't like oral presentations. I did my movie making and I kept to myself, and I went to film school, and then I had to start. And then once I did this gig and a career I really created for myself, I had to learn. I mean, this is the mid 90s. This is really, I feel that that's still almost pre-internet. The internet was just starting to become a factor. So you'd have to go to a show and find a publicist. They said, oh, I'm wearing a red jacket. And then you get there, it's like 5 people wearing a red jacket. They're all women or men. And you're like, oh, and you had to learn to speak to people you didn't know. And so I've had to do that. But I do understand when you can get, I've tried to temper things. Like when I'm in a conversation, I can get intense something. I'm like, all right, I'm just going to make a light joke now and kind of pull it back. Some artists are like that. I know people who just get very passionate about what they do, but then you do have to socially occasionally pull back. Okay, I got to make a light joke now or lighten the mood a little bit,
Yeah.
I understand also what you're saying about emotions. I mean, I, I feel like I'm an emotional person, but you know, my father's a pragmatic scientist. He got it. He studied geology at MIT, and my mom is from Cuba and she's a classically trained pianist who's more emotional. So there's a mixture that I have there of the two that are kind of pushing and pulling within me. So I understand sometimes like I might not respond to something. It depends. Like I try to be objective about stuff. And during the pandemic, I know my girlfriend and other people haven't been happy about a lot of things. I'm trying to be not freaking out too much, I guess, in a sense, because if I do that, it probably just makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then it's hit me later on. I'm sure you maybe feel the same way. Like you can get hit with emotions when people aren't around and you're like, oh, you suddenly feel a little overwhelmed by something and maybe you're not expressing it publicly. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. No, it feels to me often like that last straw, something will happen and it will be a relatively minor thing, but that's enough to tip you over the edge. When I was younger, it felt as if I was never able to, emotions would build and build and build, but it would never go back. It wasn't like that. It would just, okay. And then it would come a point, it would go, poof, I'd go absolutely mad about nothing, you know, some trivial little thing, seemed like a massive overreaction to everybody, but it was all of it come out then, and then I would be empty again, and it would start to fill up and fill up, fill up. And I could see other people get angry and it would go back.
Well, we kind of catalog it. We wait, and then the dam, it builds up, and then the dam bursts.
Yeah.
I mean, your emotion and your ideas come out in the music.
Mm-hmm.
You've obviously found the right partner who understands you very clearly.
Oh, God, yeah.
You've been together a long time. I know she was a fan beforehand, but she clearly understands who you are. And I'm assuming by now your kids do, for all your moods and quirky artist sensibilities.
Yeah. Well, I've been together with Gemma now for nearly 30 years. So you're right from the beginning. She was fantastic for me, and she understood me, and she's able to, I was a very difficult person when we met, you know, yet she had the patience and perseverance to deal with that and then try to make me understand why I was like that. And so get better and identify the things that I did that were, difficult or unpleasant. A lot of my dealing with the Asperger side of me is thanks to her, because she helped me identify when I was being Asperger's-y, you know. And I think if you got, you know, if you're sort of reasonably bright, you can identify certain behaviors which might be inappropriate, and you can modify them, you can adapt. And it might not be a natural thing, it might be a mechanical kind of solution, but it works, you know. I have a thing with eye contact. You know, eye contact is a real issue. And so I count all the time I'm speaking to people face to face.
Yeah.
I'm counting, you know, and I don't look anyone in the eye for more than 5 seconds, because that would be too intense. And I don't look at anybody for less than 3, because that would imply I'm not interested in what they're saying, which is my system anyway. So the whole time I'm talking to somebody, I'm counting. You know, so I actually find conversation quite stressful, tiring, because I'm doing sort of math the whole time. You know, 1, 2, 3. And in my head, I'm talking, I'm counting at the same time. I'll look away and I'll come back again. So, and it's all artificial, because I don't know how to be for real.
Well, you know, I'm one of those people that talks and they look off and I'm talking and they look back at the person. I kind of look around a lot. And sometimes I catch myself like, am I doing that too much? You know, because there's some people that are like that will look directly. Everyone has it. And I've thought about this as I get older now. And I just think about how, you know, body language, like you can sit there with your arms crossed. And for a lot of people, that means you're bored or you're unhappy. And sometimes it's me, I'm distressed in my arms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's weird. Like there's basic cues that, you know, that people are going to interpret in a certain way. And then there's sometimes you do have to learn with certain friends, well, that's just the way they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I know it. And I part of the reason I love this job is I don't have to meet a lot of you guys, you know, just randomly on the street. You know, because I'm sure you're tired of me, Gary Newman. Hey, you know, like it's, and sometimes I understand how that's strange for people, you know. I mean, if they get approached a lot, I'm glad I've had a chance to interface this way. And if I do meet somebody in person, I'm like, hey, you know, we had this chat or whatever. Right. Now, do you have any travel tips for people? Like good travel tips for people who maybe are newer travelers, if they're going to make the most, the Newman way, how do you enjoy the most out of your vacation?
I'm really, really pedantic about documentation. I have everything printed out in the order that I'm going to need it.
Ah, interesting.
And I have a file and everything I'm going to need, you know, from flight tickets to car hire, right. Hotels, all of that, all in the order that I expect it to be requested, so that I don't panic. I'm a terrible panicker when I'm faced with authority, and I get really intimidated really, really quickly by an immigration officer or something like that. I'm really, really like a little boy, nervous little boy. And so I like to have everything ready, everything in order. Yeah. So yeah, that would be my tip. Get yourself in order. Don't bumble up to the immigration man. It's not fumbling in your bag. You know, oh, I've got it here somewhere. You know, don't do that. Oh,
especially when you're going to Cuba. I went there 4 years ago on a Fast and Furious 8 junket. And like, my mom's from there. So I got to sort of see, well, I got to see post-communism as opposed to when she was there. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're walking in this room and half every other fluorescent light is out in the waiting area. And then you get there, and I brought a camera. I had no problem. Another guy that I knew that was in the media, he was got all his stuff searched. I think we saw sort of a confrontation with a tourist and police out there. And then of course you get tossed in jail for the night. You know, you can't get annoyed by that. You're in a communist country. So avoid doing anything that will get you in trouble. I mean, unless somebody starts a fight with you, just, you know, be cool. You know, different countries. And I'm sure you know this. Imagine you've been in the Middle East and, you know, you have to different countries. You have to behave differently. You have to understand what the culture is and respect the customs.
Yeah. Just a little bit of research before you get there. Especially if you're going sort of somewhere a little bit out of the norm, if you're not going to main Europe, you know, place like that, you know, just do a little bit of research, find out what's acceptable. There are some countries, you know, where showing the soles of your feet is deeply insulting.
Where? Well,
I can't remember now. I had to research it again. But, you know, stuff like that, you need to know that. You know, you could really, really get into trouble.
Isn't it interesting how, like, we can do all these things and then you forget, like, oh yeah, I did this. Like as I've gone on, I've been doing this 26 years now. And I'm thinking, wow, I forgot I interviewed this person. Like, how could I do that? And you've probably had so many experiences when you're writing your book, you're like, oh yeah, I did that. And it's amazing. And that at least it means you're living a full life.
Yeah. Well, since I finished the book, and the book's 45 chapters long, you know, it's massive. There's a lot of detail in there. And all I've done since I wrote it is just keep adding, remembering things I forgot to put in it. I've got a massive list on my phone now for when the paperback comes out. I've got to write loads more sort of anecdotes about, and some of them are sort of pretty major things that I just totally forgot. And every day I'm thinking, oh, I should have written about that, you know. So yes, so far, been an amazing life.
That's cool.
You know, not all great, but all worthwhile. And I've still got, you know, plenty of time left, hopefully, to add a bit more to it.
Yes, that's the attitude. Well, listen, it was great to chat with you.
Oh, thank you, man. Andrew.
Well, good luck. Hopefully this new album will do just as well as the last one.
Oh, I hope so.
Regardless, I'm enjoying it, you know.
Thank you. Good. Thank you.
Hopefully we'll chat again sometime.
I hope so. See you again.
Thank you, sir. See you later on. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That wraps up the latest Side Jams. Please join me for the next episode, which will feature guitarist Andy Summers. As always, my theme music comes from Fox and the Law, licensed through AudioSocket. Thank you very much for listening.